what we're going to cover today, what we started to cover on Thursday, this is going to be a little bit messy, so I apologize. The problem is this material is scattered throughout a couple of the books, and it's not very thoroughly covered. And so what I've tried to do is bring it together in a way that describes some of these energy loss mechanisms well enough that you can understand the discussion that we will have. Okay, it'll be a bumpy ride. My notes are kind of messy still, so I apologize for that. Okay, so the first thing that talk a little bit about the kinds of things that we're going to talk about. So we talked about various energy loss mechanisms, but now we're going to talk about things that are, well, they each have very different physics going on, but in general, there are three overall issues. There's the electronic structure of the materials that we're dealing with. By electronic structure, I mean the energy levels of the electrons, and in particular in solids, without going into it in too much detail, I will just review some basics about what energy levels in solids look like. There's also electromagnetic radiation production. I don't know what else to call it. But this category includes the effects that we call, and I've mentioned before, Cherenkov radiation and transition radiation. And in this particular case. And then the other one is phonon production. And this one, I don't know how many of you have had an undergraduate course in solid state or condensed matter physics? Just raise your hand if you've had such a course. Okay, one person. Okay, so I'm going to talk about it. I'll just sort of introduce it a little bit to today if we get far enough along. But if you have questions, ask me. I can beef it up. I can add more material as we go to make it, because you will want to understand this for certain kind of detectors, and for some of the effects that we'll talk about today, it will come up. Okay, so these are sort of the three things. They seem very different, but the couple of them come into play in a couple common areas. Now, the first thing that I want to do, and let me say, too, that we're going to talk about four effects. So I already started to talk about scintillation. All right. As I mentioned, we're going to talk about Cherenkov, transition radiation, and phonon production. So these are the four things that we're going to do to cover up the, quote, week three material. But the first thing that I want to do is I actually want to take a step back before talking about the explicitly particle physics aspects and talk a little bit about what's going on in solids. And this in particular refers to what we could call band theory of solids. It has to do with the structure of energy levels in solids. And there's also this issue of what's going on in terms of phonons and things like that. What does phonon mean? So this is sort of, I don't know, condensed matter 101. We're not going to cover it in very great detail. The first piece, what I'm actually going to do, and I'll link this on the webpage, but this is just very introductory. It's from notes that I had from our modern physics class. But it's basically the theory of energy bands, in this particular case, talking about semiconductors, but really it's going to come up when we talk about scintillators. And I realized that when we started talking about this last time with scintillators, really we need to cover this ground at least briefly. Of course, I don't know. So, well, here. Sorry. Okay, sorry for the delay. Okay, so we have to go through this in any case to talk about various things that we're going to talk about in this course. So ignore the title semiconductors. Let's just talk about solids in general in terms of their electronic properties. So first of all, solids we know are divided into sort of three categories. There's conductors. And then what's given to the right here are the materials' resistivities, which are very, very low for conductors. Semiconductors are several orders of magnitude higher resistivities. And then at the bottom, you have insulators, which have very, very large resistivities. And so numerically, they kind of fall into these groups. But in some generic way, the question is, well, how do we understand why we have these? And in particular, there's actually seems to be a gap between the different categories. So why is this? Well, if you think about it from the point of view of, go back to sort of Schrodinger's equation, and you think about the energy levels in an atom, you can have, for a single atom, you can have two energy levels for an electron, okay? However, when you bring that atom closer to another atom, the other atom has some electrical field and wave functions that at some point start to modify the potential of the atom that you're dealing with. And so what happens is you start to get a modification to the wave function of the electron, for instance, that you're talking about at the moment, and you start to get splittings of the energy levels for that atom, okay? So as you move, this is delta x is the distance from, say, well, the typical distance in a solid. If you were to then, instead of just have two atoms that you brought closer to each other, if you were to have 11 atoms that were sort of bunched together into a little nugget of material, then what you would have is you'd have 11 very closely spaced energy levels, okay? Now, this is a very crude drawing, but there's sort of 11 lines here and 11 lines here. Now, you can still see the energy levels coming from this energy level are still distinct from these energy levels, but they also do congregate in sort of a cluster of energy levels, okay? And that, at some point, when that number of atoms goes high, as it would be in a solid, this becomes just almost a continuous band of energy levels, okay? So that's kind of a conceptual idea. But what I wanted to do was talk about this a little more quantitatively because it underlies a few different kinds of phenomena that are happening in materials that I don't think that we can talk about sensibly without going through this. So this is just at the Schrodinger equation level. This is not, you know, graduate level. So, but it's just trying to review, or summarize it. So let's just think about it really simply. If you think about, you have a solid has an array of atoms, okay, and an array of atoms is really just an array of potential wells, Okay? That's all. That's what a solid is. From a point of view of an electron, it's just an array of potential wells, one after the other. Now, they could be in two dimensions and three dimensions, but it's just an array of potential wells. And so we can, now, the potential for an atom won't be a box, won't, you know, it'll be some smoothly shaped function. But we could try a simplified case where we say, well, you know what, we're going to take each atom, or molecule for that matter, but each atom, and we're going to call them each a square well potential. Okay? So you can then just take square well potentials. Here's an atom here, here's an atom here, here's an atom here. Obviously, the electrons want to be near the atoms. They don't want to be away from the atoms. Okay? So you have all these, and it just goes ad infinitum in X or Y or Z. Okay? And if you do this, well, in general for the Schrodinger equation, kind of simplistically, when you're in the well, the electron has some kinetic energy, E, and if that kinetic energy is higher than the potential V, which is, in this case, zero in this model, then the solution in the Schrodinger equation are these sinusoidal functions. It's a free particle in the well. It has more kinetic energy than the potential energy. So it could just sort of go sloshing around, bouncing around in the potential well. Okay? And the solutions have in them this wave number, K, which is a function of the kinetic energy of the particle. Okay? Now, in the barriers between the atoms, you have the case where the kinetic energy is less than V naught, the potential energy in that region. And in these cases, the solutions to the Schrodinger equation are not sinusoidal, they're exponential. Usually this would correspond to tunneling cases or exponentially falling off wave functions. Okay? And there you have alpha is a function of both the potential and the kinetic energy. Okay? But the kinetic energy is less than the potential. Okay? Potential energy. So these are the wave functions you have, and what you would do in this Kronig-Penney scheme is you try to figure out, you know, as much as you can about what these wave functions look like. And it's very complicated. However, you can use boundary conditions to come up with this expression at the top, okay? And there's a bunch of algebra here. I'm not going to go through. It's not important. But you can use boundary conditions to determine that this expression on the left, which is related to the structure in the wells, the behavior of the electrons in the wells, is related to this expression on the right, which has information about what's going on in the barriers. Okay? Now, this expression in brackets, you could plot as a function of Ka on this axis. Okay? And it would look, this is a pretty pathetic drawing by me, but it would have some behavior. Okay, it's some superposition of a sine and a cosine. Okay, who cares about the exact shape? But it goes over some range in Y here. However, you know this is a cosine, has to be within plus or minus 1. It can never be more than positive 1, and it can never be less than minus 1. Okay? So what happens is that means that it doesn't matter what this side is, this equality is only true when the stuff in the brackets is within plus or minus 1. So the only valid cases are these cases here. So this, any Ka value, and Ka corresponds to an energy of the electrons, has to be either in this range here, or in this range here, or in this range here, or in this range here. It cannot be, for instance, in this range. The energy of the particle cannot be in that range. Okay? It's just not consistent with the boundary conditions of the problem that we set up. Okay? So what you see, though, is you get just sort of a band of energy. This is now a little more mathematical version of the statement that I made earlier. But you have discrete bands of energy, and you can look at those bands versus Ka, and there's gaps. As I said, you can't have an energy, you cannot have a Ka in this region, which means that you can't have an energy in this region, okay? And so if we were to look at energy levels, what you'd see is you'd have a band here, 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 okay? So this is a basic model of solids. It's valid in many cases, and it's basically what I said in the beginning, that when you start adding up a whole bunch of atoms or molecules together, you modify the individual pristine wave functions that you think about for an atom, and you, since you have so many atoms, you sort of smear them out into bands. Okay? Now, there's one other aspect of this that I want to go into before I dump these notes. Let me make sure. Yeah. So, for now. So, the thing about it is that this actually has to do with how we understand the difference between conductors, insulators, and semiconductors, in the sense that when those bands, so the bands, here's a band here, this thing, and here's a band here, okay? Now these bands come out of the kind of analysis that I just showed you, but the atoms themselves have some energy levels, okay? So in particular, there are energy levels that are open to take electrons, and there are energies that are not. And in conductors' case, it turns out that the open energy levels are right next to the closed, if you will, filled energy levels. Okay? And so these are called conduction. These are called conduction levels, and these are valence levels. But what happens is because they're so close together in a conductor, it's very easy for a bound electron to move up into an open energy level and just start moving all around the conductor. In an insulator case, the valence levels are very far apart. They're in a different band than the conduction levels. So now an electron has to cross this big energy barrier to get into a conduction band, or it can then find some other atom to associate with, essentially. Okay? And in a semiconductor case, it's kind of like the insulator case. It's just that the bands are closer together. They're on the order of one electron volt, and because the probability to cross that gap is an exponential function of the energy, the probability to get to the conduction band is now not negligible, as it is in an insulator, okay? Now, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself because we're not going to talk about semiconductors immediately, in any case, this band idea or description of solids is important, and it relates to what we started to talk about in scintillators, and I erroneously tried to omit it, but I think it's better that we go into it. Okay, so that's the first thing. The second thing is talking a little bit about phonons. So a few more of you have come into the room. How many of you have had condensed matter or solid state? Okay, one or two people? Okay. So, all right. So first we need to define some terminology. So in a material, we could go back again to this idea that a solid is just a general case where you have two atoms. But if you imagine that you had two atoms and they're sort of coulombically attached to each other, okay, then you can sort of think of them, sort of, as if they're on a spring. I mean, this is kind of not really right, but if you were to plot the potential energy versus the separation, okay, the potential energy would be something, it looks kind of like this. Okay, it goes up very high, fast as you get down to zero separation, and it goes up here and flattens out. But in this region, it's roughly parabolic in shape. Okay? And when it's roughly parabolic in shape, okay, that is very much analogous to the case, and I'm going to get it wrong, but I'm sure I'm going to get the two wrong, but it very much can look like the potential energy that you would have for a spring, where you have a spring constant K. Okay? So, now this is only an approximation in this region. Okay? If you go at really large distances, forget it. But what's happening here is when I take the atoms, if I push them too close together, they want to push apart. If I pull them far apart from each other, they want to pull back. And so obviously, if I get them a little off, they'll just start to oscillate. Okay? So this oscillating motion, this is vibrational energy. And so there are vibrational states to this, in this case, diatom molecule, that can be populated. Very much in the same way that you would think of as the electron energy levels. It's just that we're not dealing with an electron in this energy level and then an electron in this energy level and this electron in this energy level. We're not talking exactly about a particle. We're talking about some sort of vibrational level that we can be in for this material. Okay? Now, so that's something that we don't often acknowledge. But you can then talk about the case, and I'm being very general here. I'm being very cursory is probably the right word, but I hope it's enough. We could talk about a We could talk about a lattice, some sort of crystal lattice that has atoms in it, in a solid. And in this particular case, we can have, it's a more complicated situation than we have here, but we can still have a situation where things in this lattice are vibrating. Okay? Now, there is a term when you study these kinds of systems, a phonon. Okay, and we're going to use this more. But what this is really referring to is, classically, what it would be referring to would be a situation in which the atoms in this material are oscillating at the same frequency. Okay? So if things are oscillating at different frequencies, you can imagine they'll damp out. Okay? But if they're oscillating at the same frequency, that might not happen. And in quantum mechanics, you think about this kind of analogously to the way you would think about the energy levels of an electron. Except you don't think about a particle like an electron, you start talking about phonons, right? So we have some amount of energy associated with this vibrational mode, and there are discrete energy levels. So the phonon is quantized, okay? And again, that's analogous to this idea how you would think about an electron. It actually, mathematically, we talk about it as having a wave particle nature, again, like you would talk about an electron. What else can I say? Okay, so when we talk about phonons, we need to think about the fact that there is energy stored in this material, not just in terms of the energy levels of the electrons due to the Coulomb potential, but also due to things like the vibrations of the atoms or even molecules in the material itself, okay? And when we talk about scintillators, this is the first place that we're going to talk about this, because it is one of the ways that the scintillation mechanism proceeds when we talk about inorganic scintillators. But then we'll also talk about phonon detection, where we're actually trying to detect this form of energy deposition. Okay, so you can have a particle going through, and it can excite the crystal lattice into vibrations. Okay, just like if a particle was passing through the material, it can excite an electron into a higher energy level. Okay, I'm really glossing over a whole lot of solid state physics in a way that I'm not used to doing so quickly. So, I mean, do you guys have any questions about this idea of a phonon or the vibrational levels? There's no bad questions, seriously. No? Okay. So the issue of losing energy to phonons or this issue of energy bands in solids, these are two concepts I want you to keep in your head. Okay, and if something doesn't make sense, I would really ask you to raise your question. Okay, so now let's go back to scintillators and think a little bit more about this. So what I want to do right now is let's go back to inorganic scintillators, right? So in an inorganic scintillator, we're talking about something very much like I just had, but so I have a crystal lattice, okay? Well, let's think about the semiconductor or the band theory that I talked about earlier. Okay. So what you can have is in the material, you can have a valence band and a conduction band. So the valence band has electrons in it, they're bound. The conduction band doesn't, and they're separated by several electron volts. So this is a insulator, okay? But what happens is a particle passes through the... Oh, I made this look like this is spatial. This is not spatial. That's a bad way to do that. A particle... Here's the material. A particle passes through this material, and what it is able to do is take an electron from here and excite it up to the conduction band. Okay? So, you know, it just interacted with the atom, and now we have an electron up in the conduction band, and that electron can move around some. Okay, so this electron that we have here can move around, but the thing, okay, so that can happen. Now, at some point, if we just have a normal substance, it may run in near a hole, an area that could accept an electron. And in that particular case, you might get a case where you have an electron plus this hole, and kind of a funny way to talk about it, but we could talk about this as sort of forming a bound state, okay? But it may be not at the lowest possible energy state that it could achieve, okay? So we sort of can have this object. I don't want to add more terminology, but I suppose it will help to understand what we're talking about. This is called an exciton, or exciton. But this thing can move around, and but the electron can be in an excited state, and the energy level of this would be somewhat below the conduction band. And eventually, what will happen is that the electron will de-excite back down to the valence band. Okay? So this is useful because of the fact that, so now when it de-excites, we produce a photon. So we've gone from some excited energy level down to some other energy level. The fact that this energy level is different than this energy level means that this photon won't be reabsorbed by the material. It doesn't correspond to the energy to re-eject the electron. But and the way that this, the thing that sort of triggers the photon to leave is sometimes that there are vibrational states in the material, and that can cause the de-excitation to happen. So the phonons are kind of interacting with the these electron hole pairs as if they're particles in a way. It's, again, I'm being cursory about it, but hopefully that makes some sense. So this photon is the scintillation photon. All right. This now, and this usually comes hundreds of nanoseconds after the initial event. The initial excitation of the electron, it takes some time for this electron hole pair to wander around and finally, you know, de-excite and produce light. Okay? So this is in an inorganic scintillator. Okay? Now, when we were talking about this before, there's a second step, which is that in some cases, what you actually want to do is you want to add a material, what is called a dopant. And this term comes up also when we will talk about semiconductors. The dopant is the sort of thing that, well, first of all, it will want to attract electrons. But it will also provide a way of having the de-excitation happen when there is some vibrational energy around. Okay. See if I can say a little more. Okay, so what we can do is we can modify this drawing a little bit. And if there is a material added in here, it may now have a energy level due to the dopant that's much more in between the two bands that we have in the material on its own. And if we have an exciton here, now what happens is we can go to this, but we can then, we have less of a transition from there to this dopant and then all the way down. And I think I have a drawing from Gruppen and Schwartz. So this is what you have when you don't, yeah, this is more, hopefully, easier. This is what you have when you don't have a dopant. So you have the conduction and valence bands, and you excite an electron, and it can form an exciton and then de-excite, and now you have the photon. But if you have a dopant in here, now you get these smaller transitions, and depending on how much dopant you add, you can control something about the rate or the energy that these transitions are. I mean, the size of this transition corresponds to a particular wavelength that you may care about. At the end of the day, you're going to read this detector out with something that has a certain wavelength range that it can sense. And so a wavelength of this light, of this transition, that's outside of that range, you won't be able to detect. I mean, or outside of this range, I should say. So by shrinking the energy level that corresponds to this transition, you have the ability to potentially observe the photons. Okay. Yeah. Say it again?
Mm-hmm. In the potential, which is
great, by the three. Say it again. Sorry. It's okay. Don't.
No,
I'm
just trying to understand this. Okay, the electron is excited to some level.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's going to de-excite to the dopant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then it's going to go back to the valence band, right?
Okay. You mean from here to here? Okay, you mean from here to here? This? Okay, so these transitions are not only radiative transitions. Okay, so you're losing energy, but you don't have to lose it to a photon. So when, okay, so I'm not going to be able to, maybe, I don't know if I'll give you the answer you want, but I'll try. So when this electron hole pair collides with the activation center, wherever this dopant is, okay, what can happen is you can either lose energy to a phonon, you could produce a phonon, or you could produce some light, okay? If you produce some light, then yes, you know. But actually, most cases that I have read about, I mean, you would produce a phonon. What would happen is that the light would get produced going from this transition here.
Okay, so the only observed energy which is produced is the photons, or
yeah. So in a scintillator, we're only talking about how are we getting the scintillation light, and in this particular case that I'm talking about, the energy that was lost to this transition, there's even a little transition here, right? So even this little bit of energy loss, but then this also, we don't see that. We don't try to see that. Okay. Now there are experiments, dark matter experiments, where you try to see that vibrational energy. But then you need really, really low noise levels to see, and we will talk about that. And that in my list earlier today, that's the phonon production and detection stuff. But But in most scintillating detectors, you don't bother, you don't see it, there's no way to really see it, and you just see the photon corresponding to this transition in this particular case. All right? So I think that's all right. I'll come back to that. Now, I think that's all I wanted to say there. Okay, so so that's inorganic scintillators, and because of the fact that you have this exciton floating around, this takes some time. What it means is that the typical time that it takes to get the scintillation light out for an inorganic scintillator, I might have written it, well, okay, here it is, takes usually hundreds of nanoseconds, which in many cases is perfectly fine, but in other cases is a very, very long time. So, however, in inorganic scintillators, the nice thing is that you get lots of light, so you get lots of photons. So these are some characteristics of those. And then we mentioned a couple other things last time, like there are hygroscopic, I won't go back into that, we already covered that better. All right? So this is inorganic scintillators. Now, there is another type, which is perhaps more complicated to talk about, or maybe not. Another type of scintillator is called an organic scintillator. An organic scintillator, there's a lot of different kinds of organic scintillators. Organic scintillators can be plastics. All of them have complicated sort of hydrocarbons or things in them, benzene rings, and so there's a wide variety, and they could be liquid organic scintillators, and there could be solids, and then there are some of the solids could be plastics. These have some nice features in that plastics, for instance, could be shaped and things like that. We'll talk about that when we get to the detector side. But from the process of how the energy loss is happening, so what you would have here would be So what you would have is, so imagine you have some block of material and a particle passing through. And now you don't have a crystal lattice usually. However, you do have, and you're not really talking about phonons for that reason, but you do have non-radiative modes of energy storage. Okay, so atoms can be moving, molecules can be moving, they can line up with each other, they can anti-align. And in particular, in the case of organic scintillators, what generally happens is that when the particle comes through, it creates some sort of excitation, some sort of excited electron. It may be an electron that's not really bound to a particular atom in the material. But what ends up happening is that the so I can only think about it in terms of steps. So basically, what ends up happening is that you excite but then there is a way in which you can have molecules interacting with each other, and they have dipole moments, and there can be something sort of like a vibrational state, but it has to do with their interaction with each other. I'm trying to avoid the terminology, but this doesn't really matter. But there's, well, okay. You can have a case where you have two atoms. They behave as two dipoles. And they can interact with each other. They can exchange a virtual photon. They can have an electromagnetic interaction. And you can, in this process, have create an excited system, some sort of excited system. And there's sort of a two-step loss of energy. One corresponds to a non-radiative loss of energy. This is not a phonon in this case, but it isn't radiative, meaning radiative. But it, you know, there is some change in the motion or alignment of the material. And then you can, another step would correspond to photon emission. So there are some analogies to the example that I talked about before. You're just not dealing with this sort of rigid lattice of material. If you want to know, and I'm not going to ask you to know, this interaction that's happening is called the Forster mechanism, and I just don't want to get into it. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. It's not important. But you can... again, what happens here is that you create an excited system that corresponds to the energy that you absorbed, okay? So, you know, when you have your particle passing through, at some point you have some particle passing through and it corresponds to some photon, there's some absorbed energy. And then this thing is going to re-radiate. Now, if this thing can absorb at the same wavelength that it radiates, we're not going to have a very useful detector because the light's never going to go anywhere. It's going to get produced by this molecule, and then it's going to immediately get absorbed by the next one. Okay? So, but because of the way that this happens, because we lose some energy non-radiatively, we get this photon emission here, and this photon emission has a longer wavelength than the original total absorbed wavelength. You know, absorbed energy is wavelength, if you like. Okay? So, this allows the material to let the photon from the de-excitation move through it. Okay. Now, the difference between these two wavelengths may not be enough for us, for reasons that we have to worry about how we're going to detect the light. But at least the material is transparent. Okay. So. Okay. I don't know if that seems clear enough, or if people have any questions. Does anybody have any questions? No? Okay, so all right, I think if there are no questions, and this right here, this is the scintillation, this piece here, that we would be looking for. So there's a diagram vaguely like this one, but it's not a band diagram with dopants and things. But we lose some energy to non-radiative processes, and then we have some energy transition for the radiative energy transition. And now the thing is that a lot of times this light, this overall transition wants to happen at fairly short wavelengths, but our standard photodetectors, for instance, a photomultiplier tube, this wants to see things around 400 to 450 nanometers wavelength. Okay, so what actually is done in an organic scintillator is to combine more than one material. So this material had, the initial material had an electron, transition, and then there was some non-radiative transition, and then there was some radiative transition, okay. This corresponds to some wavelength, but that wavelength may be too short for our photomultiplier to do. So for instance, maybe this is 300 nanometers. We need it to be 400 to be able to be registered by the photomultiplier. So what we end up doing is putting another material in the solution, in the material that we have, the plastic or organic scintillator, that has sort of the same pattern in miniature. So it has a non-radiative transition and a radiative transition. So if this whole thing was 300 nanometers, then these are energies, okay? Then this transition is even a smaller energy, which means a larger wavelength, and so we wave shift, this is what this is called, or wavelength shift. You are shifting the wavelength. What you're trying to do is generate this radiation and then get it to a wavelength that you can sense without losing photons. So you want every one of these to produce one of these, and every one of these to produce one of these, and there might even be another step. So you don't want to lose light. You don't care if you lose energy. You don't care if your wavelength gets bigger. That's okay, because you want to count photons. Okay, you want to see how many photons are actually made. All right? So this is called wave shifting. But it's not all that different from the initial step. Okay? You just sort of put a bunch of them in there. And the books, Grubin and Schwartz, I think, has more examples than Fernow, but, you know, you can combine different sorts of materials to get it to go right to where it is. And one should remember that you're not limited to only photomultiplier tube detectors. There are semiconductor detectors nowadays that have a variety of wavelengths they can sense at. So it's not as simple as just getting it to 400 nanometers.
Well, for the wave shifters, is this something that you put around?
No, it's in,
it makes it
These are plastic scintillators. You sort of make a solution. So you pick your chemicals, and they're just all uniformly spread through the plastic or whatever. If it's a liquid scintillator, it's just dissolved in. And, it's just uniformly done, which is a little different than the dopant situation. But yeah. Okay. Now, there's a couple aspects here. By definition, these are usually chosen to give a final wavelength range of 400 nanometers. The nice thing about these is that the lifetimes are around 2 nanoseconds or less. Okay? So if you have a really fast experiment that's taking events very, very fast, then and you don't want to have overlapping signals, then having a very fast scintillation signal is very useful. If you don't care about that, then actually the inorganic is better a lot of times, because you get more light from the inorganic than from this. So you have to juggle. You have to decide which one is the one that's more appropriate to your case. Sorry, my notes are such a mess. One point that I would make about scintillators that I hope we will get to before all is said and done is that in a particular... So this is true of scintillators in general. So we're talking... Right now what we're talking about is I've got a material and a particle passes through and I'm just going to get a flash of light around the time that this particle just flew right through the system. Okay? That's fine. However... there is a situation in which I put enough material here. I may put several blocks of it. Okay. However I do it, where the particle stops and it loses all its energy in this material. Okay. So this would correspond to a calorimeter, which we'll talk about later. But now what's happening is that not only is the initial particle causing scintillation, what's really happening is if this were, say, an electron, I'm producing a photon, which is producing an E plus E minus pair, and all of these I'm getting all of these particles that are just branching off, and I'm getting many, many, many particles in this scintillator. Okay? And it just it's very, lots and lots of branches, and they, the particles get produced and produce many, many, many. So what I'm actually getting is scintillation light produced by each of these particles at the end of each of these branches, or even during, before they end up on a branch. So here. Okay? So all of these paths have some chance to produce some scintillation light. And what I'm going to do is just take a big sum of all of this light that I see here, 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 And that's going to tell me how much light the whole particle produced. But the problem is that in a scintillator, this is not true of an ionization signal. So we talked about ionization. We saw that ionization, functionally, is a function of the energy of the incident particle. But in the case of scintillation, this is not a linear function of the incident energy. So this is a point that I tried to make about ionization that was very nice. It sort of naturally is. In ionization, if I have more energy, I get a result that scales in that way. But here it's much more complicated, particularly when I get a lot of charge nearby. I get a lot of ionization in happening. Okay, so this, because it's nonlinear, it means it's harder to calibrate in many cases. So, and what it actually means is you get a different response, meaning if you put in a 50 GeV particle, you'll get this amount of scintillation if you have this one particle. For different species of particle. So if I put a 50 GeV pion and a 50 GeV electron, I will not get the same amount of scintillation. Okay? So that has drawbacks. Okay. So that's all I was going to say about scintillation. I sort of grabbed that from a few different places, but do you have any questions about that aspect? No? Okay. So, Okay. What I want to do now, let me go a little quicker. What I want to do is talk about Cherenkov radiation and transition radiation. I mean, I get the photons today. There's one other thing I wanted to do for scintillators. This is actually, we talked about what the wavelength was of the scintillator that came out of the scintillator. So these are a bunch of inorganic scintillators. I had mentioned BGO and sodium iodide. This is the doping, so thallium, cesium iodide. So you see that they tend to peak at mostly, aside from cesium iodide, they tend to peak around 400. This one is low, but we usually don't use it that way. I think these are both organic scintillators, but again, they're put together in such a way to come out around 400 nanometers. Okay, but you see there's a fairly broad distribution, but it does peak fairly strongly in that area. Okay, so for Cherenkov, all right, so let's go to the next thing. So, let's imagine we have a particle passing through a material, and this material has some index of refraction. All right. Okay. And whenever we have a medium that has some index of refraction, it is actually possible for the particle, the particle to actually travel with a speed which is greater than the speed of light in that medium. So this particle might have some velocity which is greater than c divided by n. C divided by n is the speed of light in the medium. Okay? This is possible to happen. There's no reason that can't happen. So what ends up happening, and I guess it would be good to look at this drawing here, as the particle is moving, there are, I don't know if you can see it, if it's good enough resolution, these are little dipoles. Can you see the little pluses and minuses? Okay, so they're tending to line up, orient themselves in a preferred way around this particle. This is when the velocity of the particle is less than the speed of light in the vacuum. And what you see, I hope, is that these dipoles are kind of symmetric in terms of being in front of the particle and behind the particle. Okay? And this is, I think I took this from Krupen and Schwarz, so you can look at this later. But what happens when you have the velocity is greater than the speed of light in the material, you get this situation where you can see that they're lining up, but they're all mostly, almost all, behind the particle, okay? And they're sort of, you know, bunched up in a way. And there is there is an analogy. There is a way to do an analogy to the way you might think of a bow shock, like if you had a sonic boom from a jet or something. It's so light coming from the, well, okay, so let me step back for a second. This particle goes through the material at this point, so what happens is as it comes, and just as it goes by, all the atoms line up all of a sudden, and then they can randomize again. So the particle just blows through, goes through really fast, and you get this sudden change in electric field and orientation of atoms. And whenever you have those kinds of things, whenever you have a change in the electric field, what's going to happen is you're going to get some radiation, electromagnetic radiation, okay? And it's going to be coherent. It's happening at one moment. And it's going to correspond to sort of a wavefront defined basically by this velocity. You can kind of see an analysis of it here in this drawing, but it's not the best drawing. So if you have a particle, it's using the naming convention there, it'll travel this distance in the length of this path is the time times the velocity. That's how long it takes the particle to go from A to B. Okay? And there is another leg. This is a right angle. So the path that the photon is going to take is going to be T times C over N. Okay, so its velocity is C over N. And knowing those two things, actually the way that Gruppen and Schwarz does this is a little more, I would say, right. The way that Fernow does it, he doesn't point out that his triangle is pointed in the wrong direction. It's sort of a oversimplification the way that he does it. But in this case, so you get light going in the forward direction, but it has some angle, and trigonometrically you could figure out that cosine of this angle is going to be the and you can simplify this, comes out to be 1 over n beta, okay? Now, this, as I said, this light doesn't get produced unless you start to get this unequal distribution over here, because the fields and everything sort of balance out on the leftmost plot. But, okay, fine. So we have this condition, and what we know is that this cosine has to be between negative 1 and 1. So let's ignore the negative 1. It has to be less than or equal to 1. That puts some bounding statement on beta. Okay? In order for us to have an angle that we could observe, it means that, so this needs to be less than or equal to 1. So it means that beta needs to be greater than or equal to 1 over the index of refraction. Okay? If beta is less than 1 over the index of refraction, this is 1 over something that's less than 1, and that means that it's greater than 1, and cosine can't be that. So this is some statement that the velocity, there's a threshold when you talk about Cherenkov radiation. And so when the particle has a velocity greater than 1 over n, then you could start seeing this Cherenkov emission. And obviously, if you're just, if it's 1 over n, then you get sort of relatively minimal effect. So if it was just equal to 1 over n, you'd get cosine of theta equals 1, which is 0 degrees. So you don't get emission, you don't get much, this angle is basically 0. But as the velocity goes up, the angle opens up. Okay? And there is a maximum angle that you can have, which corresponds to the case where beta is equal to 1. So that's the fastest that the particle can actually travel. And if beta is equal to 1, then that means that this angle equals the arc cosine of 1 over n. So this is the maximum Cherenkov angle. However, this is really the angle that you normally observe, because what happens is if you deal with a 1 GeV electron, its beta is 1. I mean, its beta is 0.99, it's basically 1. Even if you're dealing with a 10 GeV muon, it has a very high beta. Its beta is basically 1. So in many cases, you're dealing with a particle that is moving very, very close to the speed of light, and so you're seeing that angle, okay? You're not seeing these intermediate angles. Okay. Okay, so there's a couple things that I would say. Oh, also, because of this, if I'm in a gas like air, n is something like 1.003. So my Cherenkov angle is going to be very, very tiny. Okay, if I use this index of refraction for air, I'm going to get an incredibly tiny. And I'm only going to be able to see Cherenkov light when my velocity is almost 1, okay? If my velocity is half the speed of light or 0.7 the speed of light, forget it, I won't see anything. However, if I'm in glass, and let's say my index of refraction is 1.5, now if my velocity is 70% the speed of light, I could see some radiation. And my angle might be sort of 40 degrees or something like that. I can get a very, very large angle in that situation. So in gases, we get very, very small angles, and we're talking about things that are really ultra-relativistic. In the case of solids, we're talking about things that can have pretty big angles, and, they're still pretty relativistic, but they're not, gammas of 100 or 10 or something like that. They can still be relatively modest, betas of 0.7, 0.8, that sort of thing. Couple points to make, that for heavy elements, Cherenkov light is less than 1% of the total energy losses that the particle has at the energies that would be appropriate. But if you had, say, if you were talking about hydrogen or helium, it could be 5% of the energy losses. So you remember the energy losses from ionization scale is the density. Okay, we talked about the radiation length. So But if you were to have a particle passing through hydrogen gas, it would lose about 5% of its light to Cherenkov radiation, whereas the other mainly would go towards ionization. And the other thing is that in terms of the intensity of the light, the number of photons, it's about 100 times on average less than scintillation. So you can't see this in a scintillator. So you need to have some material that isn't going to give you scintillation. You just want to have a situation where you will just have the Cherenkov emission. Okay?